Welcome to the Parent Advocate Podcast, a show where we celebrate, defend, support, and uplift the voices of the LGBTQIA community. I'm your host, Stephen Chikumba. My pronouns are he, him, and his, and I'm joined by my amazing co-host, Lisette Trujillo.
Hello, everyone. Lisette here, she, her, ella. The mission of the Parent Advocate Podcast is to elevate conversations and reframe narratives around trans and non-binary youth to help change hearts and minds. Each week, we bring you our take on all things happening from the perspective of two parents of BIPOC transgender kids.
We're back, Lisette.
That's right, Stephen. It's been a while, but we've got a really good episode in store, especially since we've got Aaron Russ on the show.
Well, I'm here for it. Welcome, everyone, once again to the Parent Advocate Podcast. Let's get started.
Let's do it.
Well, Guan, Lisette, what the Guan? It has been a hot minute since we've been able to record one of our shows. Like, what's been up? I feel like I'm totally out of the loop right now.
Yeah, I don't know what's been up. It feels like a time warp. Like,
yes.
Let me think. Daniel went to prom. Ooh. That was exciting.
Tell me about it.
He had a lot of fun. He went with his friends. And of course, they didn't plan anything. So like the moms were like, what? There's no planning that's gone into this. So anyway, last minute plans had to fall into place. Parents got together and were like, we got to make this better. And
I just tell you that, like, I'm a little jealous because I don't have a child going to prom. Hobbs has zero interest in going to it. And it also conflicts with Ashaming's graduation. They're on the same date. So first he was like, I'm going to prom. And then he was like, I'm not going to prom. And I can't really be mad at him. But I'm like, man, it's lucky you had trans prom. Although that's not the same thing. But again, I'm happy that Daniel went to his prom.
Yeah. He told me last minute. It was like Wednesday, prom was on Saturday. I was like, wow. What are you going to wear? Yeah, that's how last minute it was. What else is going on in our world? We're planning for trans youth at the Capitol, which is really exciting. It's a few organizations all working together to bring youth to the Capitol to meet with legislators and all the things. It'll be exciting. It's just been a mess down here, Stephen. But... But parents are good. Like, I mean, you know how it is. I run a large parent group here and the parents seem to be okay, navigating everything okay. But it's a shit show in Arizona. And Jose and I have just been working. I got a facial today. It feels like I got some self-care in. All the good things. Tell me about you.
Oh my goodness. So I literally just completed an interview for NewJersey.com because apparently they found out that the Dads has been nominated for a GLAAD Award and for an Emmy Award. So they wanted to talk to one of the cast members when they found out that one of the cast members was from New Jersey. So that's cool. I have no idea when it's coming out, but I know the reporter had like a deadline of Tuesday to get the interview in. So that was pretty cool. We have a film crew coming to the house for a special that we're shooting, which, as you know, I can't talk about fully, but we'll definitely share more about when we get the green light. But the location crew was here this week, scouting locations and getting a feel for where they wanted to shoot tomorrow. So that's coming up, super exciting. And they're so nice. The crew is so lovely. I'm really excited about the shoot. So again, can't talk about it in depth, but when I can, I will. And last week was my birthday.
Happy birthday. Wait, does that make you an Aries or a Taurus? Because my birthday was in the beginning of the month. Okay, got it.
Aries also has horns, so I guess that was really helpful to show you with my... My birthday was last week, and I got laced once again with more Adidas gear. I am, like, I can't wait for the next time I have something to go out to, because I'm going to be rocking this ill tracksuit, baby blue, Beckenbauer, so fly, and the golf shirt with the repeating Adidas logo pattern, pink, super fly, athletic cut. Just can't wait. I just can't wait for the next occasion that I get to go out and rock it. Literally, because it's been so long, I go on and on and on and on and on, but there's so much we've got to talk about. And before we lose track of time, let's get to today's topics.
Sounds good.
So the Supreme Court decided to let Idaho enforce the ban on gender-affirming care for trans youth in the state. Now, they decided on an issue brought by the state strictly on procedural grounds. Essentially, the Supreme Court let the Idaho law stand, and they permitted the injunction that was filed contesting the law to remain in effect solely for the named plaintiffs in the lawsuit, which means that even though the injunction was for all trans youth in the state, the injunction was only allowed to stand for the specific named plaintiffs in the state. Now, I can tell you that the first time I read the headline about the Supreme Court's decision, I nearly lost my mind because I was just like, oh no, the first domino has fallen. But it wasn't until I actually read the article and then read the actual opinion or decision from the court that I recognized how absolutely limited it was. And it had me a little pissed off that like media is not doing a better job of preventing folks like me from having heart attacks.
Yeah. And I think too, I too had the same reaction, and I had to like text a few lawyers and like look at what was going on and double check because I too was in a panic. And I have to say my heart is with everyone in Idaho who's just lost care. It doesn't go into effect for like another 30 days, right? They gave like a grace period. And I'm so glad that the plaintiffs got to keep their care. I think that says something, but I'm scared about it all sort of moving along.
So one of the things that actually keeps me from despairing is the fact that, like you said, the plaintiffs got to keep their care because the plaintiffs' counsel made a showing that the plaintiffs would likely be successful on the merits when the case was tried. And that's important because the injunction would not have been granted if they did not articulate a case that was winnable. And so, like, I keep my fingers and my toes and my legs crossed because I think when it comes down to actually deciding these cases on the merits, unless you're in a place that has like a Republican supermajority where they're just a bunch of dummies, these cases can be won.
Yeah, I agree. I have like all the Palo Santo and sage and all the things burning and like a little candle. I'm like, oh gosh, it's just, I think what people don't understand is that there's been so much misinformation put out and that it's made parents like us fearful to be transparent in what care looks like for our children and how necessary it is. All right, enough of the stress panic heart attacks. Here's another one. Did you hear that the Moms for Liberty co-founder tried to tell Americans that they have a lot in common with Trump? Speaking at a conservative rally in Florida, Moms for Liberty co-founder Tiffany Justice told the crowd that the Department of Justice was coming after Trump today, but would be coming after ordinary citizens tomorrow if they weren't stopped. Then she went on to make light of the fact that when her daughter Googled Moms for Liberty, the Southern Poverty Law Center listed them as a hate group.
Okay, so I have a lot of things to say about this. First, is she crazy? Because she sounds crazy saying that Americans have a lot in common with Donald Trump. It's like Donald Trump saying that Black people like him because he is a man with 90-something indictments. You need to stop that. You need to stop. Most Americans have nothing in common with Donald Trump. Full stop. And the only people that have anything in common with Donald Trump because of the Department of Justice are people that have charges with the Department of Justice for being criminals or alleged criminals. So she just needs to stop all the bullshit. Please.
I just think it's crazy that they're trying to make white-collar crime cool again.
They're not doing a good job. I'm sorry. When your daughter Googles you and you come up as a hate group on the Southern Poverty Law Center's like hate crime stats, you're doing wrong. There's something wrong with you. The KKK is on that list. There are legit hate groups on that list, and you're like making fun of it. You think it's a funny thing. There's something wrong with you, white lady.
Daniel sent me a reel on Instagram that was a reporter asking a Trump voter a question about Trump, and he said, in 2,000 years, we're going to see Trump like Jesus, because he's our modern Jesus. And the reporter asked him, and he's like, just look at all the apostles. They were all criminals. And I was like, where is this like Jesus and everyone's criminals and like trying? They are working hard to justify Trump's.
Bible. Come on now. You know the one with the Constitution and the Bill of Rights? That one. That's where they found this craziness. Wait. Can we talk about your state for a second?
Oh, gosh. Yes.
Your state is coming with a whole new level of cray. The Supreme Court there allowed a near total ban on abortion from 1864. Did you hear me? I said 1864. I didn't say 1964. I said 1864 to go into effect. To make this even more bonkers, the day before the Supreme Supreme Court decision, anti-abortion members of the House took to the floor, praying and speaking in tongues. Lisette, what's in the water? What's in the air? What are y'all smoking? And please make sure you pass me by when it comes my turn in the cipher, because I don't want no parts of it.
Well, first off, we're running out of water, so I don't know what they're drinking. But yeah, prior to the speaking in tongues prayer, 2 days prior, another House congressional leader or another House leader had given an anti-trans prayer that equated this moment truly being light against darkness, and anyone else was demonic, and it was, a war for the Jesus. And so you're talking about religious rhetoric, Handmaid's Tale type shit, like happening. I was telling Jose, this is the first time in my entire life where I literally do not own my own body.
Lisette,
I can't make medical decisions on certain things that I may need as a woman in this state. It's crazy.
I just want to remind everybody that the reason the colonists left the other side of the pond was to escape the maniacal, religious organizations that were depriving regular citizens of their rights, were forcing people to tithe, essentially, the government. And they were like, you know what? We're going to create a state where there is a separation between the church and the state. We have enshrined that into our founding document. We are not going to be beholden to a monarch who is appointed by God.
Yep.
And here we are on the House floor of our state legislatures, speaking in tongues and praying to be saved from these demonic trans people. Have you fucking ever?
And then yesterday, they passed a repeal on the 1864 bill, right? Ban.
Congratulations.
So it's moving to the Senate, and if it passes, then it'll go on to the governor's office, like governor's desk, to sign. But now they're punishing Representative Oscar de los Santos, who is a minority leader, for pushing the repeal of this, for doing the right thing. They're punishing him. They're moving him off committees. It's awful. It's disgusting the lengths that the GOP will go to here to manipulate and get what they want. But then again, right, we just saw Froddick and everyone who got indicted in Arizona for trying to push that law. So I'm just patiently waiting and watching. But honestly, it looks like a circus. We're the Wild West of Florida.
Yeah, y'all are wild for the night.
Yep, just craziness. According to the Associated Press, Tennessee lawmakers just approved a bill that would penalize adults who assisted transgender youth access to gender-affirming care. On Thursday, Tennessee's GOP-controlled state house gave the final approval to legislation penalizing adults who help minors receive gender-affirming care without parental consent, clearing the way for the first in the nation proposal to be sent to Governor Bill Lee's desk for his signature. The law would cover violations such as directing minors to websites on where to find care or helping a minor travel to a different state with less restrictions on gender-affirming care.
No surprise there. Like, literally, Tennessee has enacted more anti-LGBTQ plus laws than any other state since like 2015, with more than 20 bills advancing out of the state legislature over the past few months. They're terrible. They're absolutely wretched and horrible and terrible and wretched and horrible and terrible and wretched and horrible. But enough with these topics. We have an amazing guest waiting in the wings, so let's get to our guest.
Let's do it.
Erin Russ is an end-of-life programs manager with Southern Arizona Senior Pride, where they help LGBTQ plus elders retain control over their lives and futures. A transgender individual with over 40 years as a community, corporate, and military trainer and educator, Erin is a past GO-DAT award recipient and a 2019-2020 fellow for the Tucson Public Voices Fellowship. They were instrumental in changing attitudes and policies regarding transgender and other queer people across Southern Arizona by providing training to public and private businesses, local and state governments, academia, social service agencies, and medical and mental health facilities. Erin currently assists LGBTQ plus people to complete their advanced medical planning documents and is developing resources to ensure solo seniors can find competent, supportive powers of attorney. Everyone, please welcome Erin Russ to our show.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Lizette, for having me here.
Aaron, we're so excited you could be here with us today. And Jose was even more excited when he learned that you were our guest.
Cool. Well, I'm glad to be here. I live my life so that I can help other people learn more about me and my community. And so any chance I get to share is important.
Well, Aaron, we're going to jump right in. One of the things that struck me when I was looking you up was your job title, End of Life Programs Manager. Now, when I hear that, I automatically think, and I'm sure many people do, of Dr. Kevorkian. But I'm sure that that's not necessarily what you do. And I'm also sure I'm not the first person who's ever asked you this. So what does it mean to be an End of Life Programs Manager?
What our goal is, what our program is designed to do is to help seniors, especially in the LGBT community, plan for that period in their life that is defined by illness and incapacity. So as we get older, more likely to get sick and not be able to make decisions for ourselves, be more severely injured in accidents so that we can't make decisions for ourselves. And we're going to need somebody else to do that. Now, there's an automatic thing that happens that if I am injured and I haven't done any planning, then there's a list of relationships that can make those decisions for me, but they can't make all the decisions I might wish. And it also is important for younger people to think about this, because when I was in my 20s, I had meningitis and I was in a coma for 5 days, and somebody had to make the necessary decisions in that time period, and I couldn't. Fortunately, I was in the Army and my former spouse was authorized to make those decisions, and so that worked. But for most of us, at least half of us are going to need to have somebody make those decisions for us at some time in our life. But only 30% of people have sat down and put together the necessary documents to make sure that their desires and their wishes are honored. For instance, one of the documents I help people put together is a medical power of attorney. That says that so-and-so will make decisions for me and is empowered to do so in any area other than that which I specifically designate. And if something happens to me, this person speaks for me and speaks for me and knows my wishes. The second part of that is actually having an advanced directive, which spells out how I want to be, what kind of medical treatment I want to have in the event that something happens to me. And that can include, if I have the power of attorney, that can include authorizing the termination of artificial feeding, artificial life support, so that I go out on my own rather than keeping me alive. And then there's a number of other things that over the last few years I've put together that are specific to the LGBT community, because most of the documents that exist for people to fill out on their own were written by cisgendered middle and upper class white males. And so there are things they don't think about. They don't think about the fact that a lesbian doesn't want her hair to grow long, or the transgender woman prefers to be treated as a woman rather than just as a piece of meat on a slab because of what's going on. And then there's memory care issues, and it got bigger as soon as I started looking into it a couple of years ago when I was doing it. So
isn't that always the way? Isn't that always the way? So it's interesting because Lizette has told me so much about you. Like, she was so excited when we actually booked you. She has continually talked about the impact you've had on her family over the last 9 years, the fact that you've been a trailblazer in Tucson, and over how the last few decades you've really focused on supporting trans youth and elder LGBTQIA folk. What do you think brought you to this kind of work?
That's interesting, because sometimes trailblazers are the person that got lost in the woods and had to kind of find their way out. And that's kind of my story. When I was in the military. Well, let me back up. I started when I was about 4 years old. I knew I was trans. I just didn't have the words to describe it. I mean, I knew that I was assigned to the wrong team and I was stuck there and there was no way out. And back in the late 50s and early 60s, that's all you had. And so I struggled with it for 43 years of my life. And when I finally came out and realized that there were other people like me that were trying to do work to help, my mission in life was to make sure that the 4 or 5 year old that I was knew that there were alternatives, that their parents knew there were alternatives, and that the 32-year-old Army officer that lost her career also had alternatives and didn't have to worry about that in the future. And so that's where I started. I started chopping down trees and clearing vines and just trying to make my way through that jungle that I found myself in. And slowly there was more space for other people, and there were a lot of people that came along to help. And Lizette was one of those. Mike, I had a big concern about youth, but didn't have any youth to deal with until we had like 4 or 5, and they started, the moms got together and the dads got together, and they just turned into forces of nature, and it helped helped me to have them to be able to fight for. And it really encourages me now to see the work that Lizette and her peers are doing in areas that 20 years ago we never thought would be possible. What got me into the senior side of things was, at a certain point, an organization needs to change and grow. Well, all organizations need to change and grow. And at a certain point, the people who are running that become the impediment to it doing what it needs to do. And I had been teaching for 6 or 7 years to people that when I was doing workshops, that in an organization, you need to be willing to step aside and let somebody else come in to do the things that need to be done that you can't do. And I found myself sitting in the office one day and said, it's time for me to go. And so I retired. And about 3 weeks later, Senior Pride offered me the position to do what I'm doing now. So it's an extension, because now I'm starting to work with senior trans people as well. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done in the community, so that senior trans people, senior LGB people don't have to feel like going back in the closet is their only way of surviving the last few years of their life. So.
Absolutely.
So I want you to tell us more about Senior Pride. What is the mission, and like, what has been exciting about this new organization that you've been working with?
Senior Pride is actually, this is the 20th anniversary of the organization starting, and it was a program of Wingspan, and then it was a small grassroots organization. And 2 years ago, they applied for and received their 501c3 designation, and recently hired an executive director to go from grassroots to more of a community support agency. For years, they've had social gatherings for LGBTQ seniors that didn't have anyplace else to go. There is a community cares partnership program that we have younger seniors paired with older seniors, or seniors who are differently abled paired together so that they can help each other. We recently got funding and approval to do a ride, to provide rides for people and have the people, drivers insured and provided with mileage. And the end of life program, which we refer to right now as advanced medical care planning, has been focusing mostly on that aspect for the last couple of years. And we've helped a number of people, several dozen people, get their powers of attorney and advanced medical documents together. We've held semi-annual resource fairs where we bring in attorneys and doctors, and we can talk about specific issues that elders run into, especially as queer people. We're also looking at ways to help seniors resolve housing issues. There are a lot of seniors, and especially in our community, who are unstably housed, and so we're working on solutions for that. And so our goal is to become more impactful, more supportive of LGBTQ seniors, so that they don't have to go back in the closet in order to receive the care they need.
Absolutely. It sounds like a wonderful organization with a super important mission. And I'm going to transition really quickly, because Lisette asked me to ask you about a particular story. As you know, our podcast is about helping parents on their gender journey with their trans and non-binary kids. And I hear there's a story about your dad in which he really showed up for you in a way that a lot of parents struggle to. So can you share that story with us?
I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get through it with dry eyes. I'll preface it by saying that when I came out, I didn't know of anybody who did not lose all or most of their family. Growing up, I knew that I was trans, but I also enjoyed doing masculine things as well. But I wanted to go to the prom in the dress, not the tuxedo. I wanted to go to the clubs in college as in the Danskin skirts and leotards and the Candies heels, rather than the clothes that I had to wear. And I wrestled with my gender identity for a long time. I was seeing a therapist in the mid-80s. In 1990, I was stationed in Alaska at Fort Richardson, and I was cross-dressing, and I narrowly avoided a traffic accident because of icy roads, and I got pulled over and given a ticket. I was wearing a cashmere dress and coat set with white heels and makeup and blonde hair, which didn't go well with the image of an army officer. I was off post, but the police officer that stopped me saw that my home address was on installation. It was a Saturday night. Sunday morning, he went to the provost marshal's office with a description of how I was dressed. On Monday morning, I was sitting in front of the brigade commander, being relieved of command and told my army career was over, and at that point, I might be court-martialed. A few days later, they accepted my resignation, and I had to basically stay almost quarantined in my quarters. I couldn't go anywhere near anything else on post. 3 weeks later, I was getting off an airplane. The night after I was relieved of command, I had to call my parents and say, myself, my wife, and my three kids were coming home from Alaska after we'd been on leave just a month previously. And so my parents asked what was going on. And I was like, well, might as well tell you. So I said I had been cross-dressing in town and got a ticket, and it got to the military and they were kicking me out. Both my parents are veterans. Their response at that point was, well, what are you going to do when you get back? And I said, I don't know. I haven't had time to think about it. And so my mom and dad said, well, we've got this big house that we raised five kids in. It's got an upstairs that's not being used. You're welcome to stay with us for a few months until you get settled. So we got back to their house, and probably a week after we got home, my dad and I were sitting out on the patio, and he asked me a little bit more about what had happened. And I explained, well, I'd been seeing a therapist for about 3 or 4 years. He had given me some books to read. I wasn't interested. I didn't want to be trans. I don't want to deal with this. I'm working very hard not to be. And so my father asked me for the books or for a list, and I gave him the book list. And that's the last I thought about it. So fast forward about 9 years, and I finally got to the point where struggling not to be who I am had gotten to be too much. I was basically spent a lot of time wondering what my other alternatives were. I tried everything. I finally realized that there was only one thing I hadn't tried, and so I needed to find out what being trans would mean for me. And so I started exploring it. Ended up moving to Tucson about that same time. I found Wingspan that was very supportive of the trans community. And so I started my transition very slowly, sort of, and didn't stay slow for long. Once I let that genie out of the bottle, there was no getting it back. I was going to be changing my name. I was going to be doing, there were a number of things I had planned. And I realized I needed to let my parents know what was going on, because already my hair had been growing. And so they came to visit Tucson, and I figured, okay, they're going to be here. I'll tell them when they get here on Friday. We'll have all weekend to talk about it. And Friday came and went. Saturday came and went. Sunday came and went. And the whole time I'm like on edge trying to figure out how to tell my mom and dad. Monday came. They were leaving right after lunch, and we went to Red Lobster, which is their favorite restaurant. Every year to celebrate their anniversary, my brother and I, we go to Red Lobster. And so spent 4 hours stringing lunch out until I got to the point where they were getting ready to leave. I said, there's one more thing we need to talk about. And my heart's beating fast, and I am not wanting to do this, because I knew everybody I knew had lost family. And I knew that my mom and dad were some of my favorite people. I really enjoyed being with them, even though most of my life they kept them at arm's distance because of what I was about to tell them. I finally said, well, there's something I need to tell you. I am transitioning to female. I will be living full time as a woman, and I'm going to be changing my name. And my mom is always the first one to comment on something. And it's usually very compassionate and usually very wise. And my dad sits back and listens and formulates his response. But before my mother could even take a breath, my father responded with, we're glad you finally figured this out. How can we help? And that was in October. Or no, that was in April. April, May? That was in the summertime because it was nice out. The most important piece to me is that I needed to then tell my siblings. And I kind of put that off over the summer because we didn't get together. But Thanksgiving and Christmas were coming, and we always got together. So I was visiting my mom and dad in early September. And my dad said, so how are you going to tell your brothers and sisters? And it's like, I don't know. And he suggested I write them a letter, at least as a way of sorting out what it was I wanted to say. So I wrote the letter and I sent it to him to look at. He said, I think that'll work. Why don't you send that to your brothers and sisters? And by now it was mid-October because I was putting it off. So I sent it to my brothers and sisters. And for Thanksgiving, my mom and dad, they took all the grandkids and they went someplace and left my two brothers and two sisters and myself alone for me to answer questions and talk to them. There were several questions. My brothers were like, okay, we're happy. I mean, we're happy, you're happy. We'll be ignorant. That's okay. And since then, they've become much, they've educated themselves, but they've always been supportive. My sisters were more interested, wanted to know more, obviously. And so we spent about 3 hours just talking. And when the kids came back, my one sister and two brothers have kids. My other sister does, but they went with their, they took their kids out and went someplace and they told their kids what was going on. My brother stayed there with his kids and he told them and they had a few questions. And then my father said, okay, so now how are we going to tell the rest of the family? And this was at Thanksgiving time. And I said, do we have to? And he said, we probably should because our 50th wedding anniversary is coming up next year and it's family reunion and we'd love to have you there. And so I said, so how do we do that? He said, well, I'm going to be sending out an end of the year letter. And what I'd like to do is take some excerpts of the letter you sent your brothers and sisters and include that. And so it's like, okay. And he sent me a copy of it before he sent it out. It was very well done. My father was very articulate. The draft didn't have a piece that basically swept me off my feet when I saw the final that he sent out to everybody. It started off with, this has been an eventful year, blah, 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 blah. The most important thing we need to let everybody know is that our son, dead name, is now our daughter, Erin. And he included a little bit of the letter that I had written to my brothers and sisters. And at the end of it, he said, this is her journey. This has been the challenge of her life. We support her in this endeavor, and we hope that you will too. Best regards, Ed and Mary, which is my mom and dad. My father was well respected by everybody who knew him. And when he said, we hope you will honor this as well, that was not an option for people. Anybody that knew him knew that he was saying, that this is important to us. This is our child. We support our child. And if you don't, that's your problem, not ours. That was such a freeing moment in my life. Because at that point, I knew that what I was planning on doing, which was being vocal for who I was and the people around me, also had my parents' support. So the last piece to that happened years later. And I don't know if I've mentioned this to you, Lizette, but when my dad died, one of the things that he said was that he was proud of me. When my mom passed away, I'm going to back up to the dinner for a moment. At dinner, after my dad had said what he said, my mom said, we're here for you. We're sorry you have to live in a world that is going to be so hard for you to negotiate. And when my mom passed, she made basically that same remark. You know, the last time I talked to her, she said, I'm so sorry you've had to live in this world. And I was able to tell her that because of their support and because of who they raised me to be, the world may have been harder for me than it needed to be, but because of who they helped me to become, I was able to work to make it better for those who followed. And she smiled, and that's the last time I talked to her. I would have done what I've done, but not with the confidence that I had, because I knew that I had parents who were supporting me. And I was in my 40s when that journey started with them. I can just imagine, let me rephrase that, I can see with Daniel that having that support from his parents at his young age, he has become a dragon slayer. He is what I would have hoped to have been had I gotten a chance when I was younger. And so when I watch our young people like Daniel and a number of the other trans youth that we've worked with here in Tucson and around the country standing strong in who they are, I actually feel like I've accomplished something.
Erin, you have to tell Stephen about the book list.
Oh my goodness, yes. When my father passed away in December of 2009, my mom wanted help going through his stuff to decide what to keep and what to get rid of. And going through his study with my sister, we came across the book list. We also found the books. Every book on that book list was in my father's library. And we're going through the books. He had read every one of them, obviously more than once, with marginal notes, highlighting, cross-referencing from book to book, and questions that he had as he was reading that then had answers a little later on. When I came out to my parents in 2001, my father and I had been doing panels and a few speaking engagements up until that point. My father knew more about what I was dealing with than I did from an academic standpoint, and he never pushed me in that 10 years from the time I left the military until the time I finally came out. He just let me. He was there every time I had a question about anything. He was very supportive, but knowing that he had spent that time, that just was, still is. It's very supportive. It's very encouraging to keep going.
That's an amazing story. Your dad, your parents were amazing people. I'm thinking back with a little bit of, you know, I'm a little jelly because the response from my mother, the response from my brother was anything but what you've experienced. And I'm sure Lisette can speak to this as well. You know, to have people close to you, support you, super important. to have them not support you, very devastating, and it's very hard to keep going. So I am very happy for you that you had supportive people, and that fear that you had about people distancing themselves from you, people that you love and held close, not having done that to you. I think that that speaks volumes about the kind of people that you have in your life, and that's amazing.
Now, I do have an ex-wife and one of my sons that are like, I'm on Pluto someplace, but you know, for the most part, I have been supremely blessed and privileged to not have lost the key people in my life. And I know that. And in a way, it's when I talk about that to audiences about how important it is to have somebody who is there for you, I can speak with authority on that and help, and hopefully help them realize that they can do that for people in their life as well.
I always share that story with Aaron's permission, because Aaron, when Aaron told me, we were at a camp for trans youth. It was camp called Camp Born This Way. We were sitting in a small circle. And when Aaron told me the story about the books, I just started crying. There's nothing more beautiful than someone seeing you before you feel brave enough to be yourself. And I think often as parents, we see our children's hearts even before they're ready to tell us. We just don't either we're afraid to use the words, or we are waiting to see if it's real, whatever keeps us from doing it. And your dad, I think taking the time to read it so that when you were ready, he could show up for you is just such a gift, and shows what an incredible person your dad was. I wish I would have had the chance to meet him. And I tell this story all the time, and parents bawl every time, I think, because he's a marker for how we should all show up for our children.
Yes, I absolutely think so as well. And he was a good example. He and my mom were both good examples for me, even before I knew that I was watching, or before I knew that I needed that.
And so, speaking of your parents, you know, I love hearing about them. I always cry when I hear about your parents. And so what do you think are like the three most important things that your parents did to offer you support that you would recommend parents do? Your top three, which I think you wove into your story, but.
Yeah. So the first one is to be accepting. When I had to resign my commission and return home, my mom and dad didn't know anything about what it was I was dealing with, but they knew that they loved me, and that I was a person with value, and that I deserved to be treated just like anybody else. And I was their kid, the oldest one. I mean, they could have traded me in because they had four more, but I was still their kid, and they were there to support me. And so I guess I would say they were not judgmental, and they were there to be supportive. Because in 1990, being gay and being trans were a whole lot less socially acceptable than they are now. The second one is to do what my dad did and learn about it without forcing me to have to be the one to do the training. And at the time, I couldn't have anyway, because I didn't know any. And I guess the third one is to let me be the one who set the pace and the direction for where I was going. And that applies to a 40, well, I was in my early 30s. I was 33 or 34 at the time. That applies to a 34-year-old or a 3.4-year-old. Don't force one way or the other. Be supportive. Don't be judgmental. And learn. Learn about it. There are plenty of resources available.
Great advice. I love it. You've been referring to this period of time where you experienced difficulty. And so you shared with us that you came into your own as an adult. But during that time when you were your authentic self, you did not have protections. There were zero protections for transgender people. So can you tell us a little bit more about what that period of life was like in 1990, and what advice you have for parents who are going through a very similar political moment where the protections that we thought existed for everyone aren't really there for our trans and non-binary children, and these attacks are kind of mounting up? What advice do you have for parents for sustaining themselves and their children through this period?
Between 1990 and 2000, I was wrestling with who I was, and I was not willing to accept it. I would occasionally go do some research in the library, but you know, at that time, the internet wasn't very prevalent. In 2000, when I came out, I realized that I had the ability to speak authoritatively as long as I did my homework. Like, people would listen to me when I spoke. I have a presence that when I'm in a room, people notice me, and I recognize that. that. And so at that point, I realized that the world sucked and I could either lie down and die or I could stand up and try and change things. And what that meant to me was I needed to start doing my homework. I needed to start finding out what it means to be trans. What's the truth? Okay. And I also realized that embellishing the truth, like some of the people I knew were doing, wasn't the right thing to do, because if you embellish the truth and you get caught at it, everything you said up till that point that may have been absolutely true becomes suspect. And so I basically became a data spewing machine. And I made sure that my story was part of what I was saying. I wanted people to know what the facts were, but I wanted them to also realize that the person providing them with that information was a human being with aspirations and fears and contributions that they'd made and goals for life that was just like them. And I found that empathy was one of the strongest weapons that I had working for me. If people got to know me and they liked me, or at least they didn't hate me when they got to know me, they would hear some of what I had to say. They wouldn't hear all the same things, but they'd hear a little bit of it and they would say, okay, well, you know, that's not what I've been hearing from these people over here. I don't know for sure how true it is, but at least I'm going to look into it a little bit more. The challenges we're facing today are that there are those who want to see us disappear from the face of the earth. Most of them are not going to do it themselves. They're just going to convince other people do it. But the information or the things that they are saying are untrue. They're lying. I actually spoke to a nursing class yesterday and was asked a similar question. It says, how do we counter all the stuff that's being put in the media these days? And it's like, my answer went like this. There's an old saying that a lie can be halfway around the world before the truth gets out of bed. The thing is that if you have the truth on your side, there are enough people who've heard the lies that want to know what the truth is and will recognize it when they hear it. So we may be at a disadvantage from the starting blocks, but in most of the cases that I know of where the legislation is challenged in court, the people who made up the lies are being called out as liars. Unfortunately, there are so many of them all over the place that the legal victories take years to happen. And in some cases, there are setbacks. It's very discouraging to families with trans kids and to young trans people to see the victories being snatched away from them. So that's a long way of saying, roll up your sleeves, be prepared for the long fight. Follow the example of Lizette Trujillo, who is one of the most tenacious people I've ever met, and just dig in your heels and don't take no for an answer. They're going to have to haul me out of this arena. Well, I'm going to use the Spartan example. They're going to have to carry me out on my shield because I'm not going away.
So. Damn right, Aaron. So I love you. Okay, here's what our final question. Jose and I were so honored to see you celebrated and getting your Silver Beaver Award with the Boy Scouts. My question to you is, what has kept you there and why do you keep supporting trans youth in a space that often can be difficult, but I know is so meaningful to you and Scotty? Why do you think it's just an invaluable resource?
So I'm going to go back to my dad. I was 6 years old, my brother was 5, and my cousin was 6 the first time I went camping with my dad. And he knew how to make a gasoline stove work, didn't burn the food, knew how to put up the tent. We had a great time, and I wanted to keep doing that. Well, I learned that my father had been a Boy Scout, but when he was in scouting, it was in the 30s and the 40s, and he turned 16 in 1943, 42. And when he turned 16, there were no adults there for his scout troop to function. So the troop committee was all the moms, and my dad became the scoutmaster. And so what he did, he gave up his opportunity to become an Eagle Scout so that a bunch of other kids in that troop had that opportunity. And he was involved with Cub Scouts when I was in Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts when I was in Boy Scouts. And what I saw from my father was somebody who saw changes that needed to happen, who was willing to work to make those changes happen, and was willing to do so selflessly. That made a big impact on me. In my military career, that was the way I approached things. When I had to leave the military, I was also kicked out of scouting. But the program itself, its basic principles and the way they go about doing things is very beneficial to young people. And just because the people who were running it for a long time were exclusionary, didn't make it right, or didn't make me see the program as being a negative impact. And so when they changed their policies, I called them up and said, hey, I know you, I see you've changed your policies. You don't know what you've done. I'm glad you did it, but I'd be glad to help because you just opened the door for me, knowing that it was going to be a challenge. And so in 2017, my friend Scotty and I, we talked to them. We had a couple of young trans boys that wanted to be Cub Scouts. And so we said, hey, we've got some transgender boys that want to be Cub Scouts. What are we going to do with that? They found a Jewish synagogue that was willing to sponsor a troop that was open to everybody. And so we had a couple of trans boys, and then we had a couple of trans girls and a couple of non-binary girls. And then COVID happened, and so we kind of put it on hiatus. But I've stayed active with the organization because I feel that if somebody has been opposing my inclusion and then they change their policy, I can't then walk away and say, well, you didn't want me then, because if I'm pushing you to change and you try and change but don't know how, I, as an individual, feel like I have a role in helping to make that happen. I don't think everybody should, but I think that me, with the gifts and stuff that I've been given, I don't have a choice not. And so I've been involved with, at the national level, doing some inclusion stuff with trans kids and their families and parents. I've been doing it locally, apparently because they gave me the Silver Beaver Award. I'm making some sort of an impact. That's another one of those places that they're going to have to haul me out on my shield.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And it's heartwarming to know that even when organizations, huge organizations, national organizations, international organizations make missteps, they can course correct and they can do the right thing. And that people like you are willing to assist them on that journey to the right path. That's just, it's a heartwarming story. And I think it's one that other organizations really need to pay attention to.
Yeah, I agree.
So Aaron, we are so honored that you chose to spend the time with us, to share your stories with us, to share your experience with us. This episode is really special, and I think that folks will take a lot away from it. So thank you again for joining us.
You're quite welcome. And Lizette can be quite persuasive.
This much.
I love you, Aaron. Thank you.
I love you too, Lizette.
Now it's time for our recurring segment, Allies and Assholes, where we highlight individuals or groups that are supporting the LGBTQIA community on the one hand and call out straight up assholes who are trying to move us all backwards on the other. Lisette, who are we talking about today?
Our ally of the week is Mayel Jack. The state legislature in New Hampshire voted to kill their anti-trans bill after powerful testimony from transgender athlete Mayel Jack. In her powerful testimony, the 16-year-old trans high jump state champion told politicians that sports had become a place that allowed her to be seen as normal and that rescinding her right to compete would be devastating. She reminded the education committee in her testimony that no one would go through the bullying and self-hatred of transition purely to win a sport, especially women's sports, which is underappreciated in our nation.
I just love the courage that Mayel demonstrated to stand in the breach and speak to the committee, because there's so much hostility towards trans girls and women, specifically in women's sports, that her speaking to the committee, her powerful testimony, her being so vulnerable was super courageous. And most importantly, she actually was able to change hearts and minds.
And that's why Mayel Jacks is our ally of the week.
Okay, congratulations to Mayel. Now on to our asshole of the week. Our asshole of the week is Texas Governor Greg Abbott. Last week, Governor Abbott was speaking at a convention for the Young Conservatives of Texas when he said that transgender people should be barred from teaching in Texas schools. Speaking of an individual teacher who donned a dress and heels at a student's behest in celebration of Spirit Day at the school, Governor Abbott described the incident as a man who would go to school dressed as a woman in a dress, high heels, and makeup. Although the teacher, who did not identify as transgender or as a crossdresser, Abbott used the incident, which was targeted by the libs of TikTok, as a catalyst to comment hate towards transgender people.
Abbott has been making anti-LGBTQ+ policy decisions a priority in his administration. So I'm not surprised he used what was otherwise a joyful occasion for kids at school as a means to further divide us.
And that's why Governor Greg Abbott is our asshole of the week. Well, that's our show for today, folks. I want to thank today's guest, Aaron Russ, for joining us. And of course, I got to give props to my co-host, Lisette Trujillo, for being the amazing person that she is with her facial.
Thanks, Steven. You know, I couldn't do this without you. And of course, we couldn't do it without all of you, our listeners. So thanks for tuning in to the Parent Advocate Podcast. And before we close, I just want to give a little shout out to one of my favorite mamas, Chris, who texted me yesterday and said, when is the next episode coming?
Well, Chris, here it is. And folks, please be sure to subscribe to our podcast on our YouTube channel, follow us on Instagram and TikTok, and do whatever you've got to do to stay up to date with everything going on here at the Parent Advocate Podcast.
Bye.
If you're thinking about harming yourself, get immediate support. Please reach out to the Trevor Project and connect to a crisis counselor 24/7, 365 days a year from anywhere in the United States. It's 100% confidential and 100% free. You can get help at thetrevorproject.org. If you'd like to support any of the organizations working actively to support LGBTQ people, please visit the ACLU at action.aclu.org or the Human Rights Campaign at hrc.org.
You've been listening to the Parent Advocate Podcast. Tune in again for another episode.